From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, we meet one of the greatest players in basketball history. Wilt Chamberlain says he was chosen to be a man of controversy. It's not just his thoughts on the game that are controversial, it's his sex life too. In his new book, he says he's had approximately 20,000 sexual partners. Also today, we remember a great innovator in classic and contemporary theater. Impresario Joseph Papp died yesterday at age 70. We'll play back an interview from 1987. E.L. Doctorow's novel, Billy Bathgate, has been made into a film. We'll hear a reading from the book by Doctorow himself and a review of the film from critic Stephen Schiff. And TV critic David Bianculli checks out Kenny Rogers' return to TV. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The first phase of the Middle East Peace Conference has adjourned in Madrid without settling the issue of where the next round of talks will be held. Israeli and Palestinian delegates will hold an initial face-to-face discussion in Madrid on Sunday to try to agree on a location. Israel has invited Arab delegates to begin the first round of bilateral talks in Israel, but the Arabs want the talks on neutral territory. Hillary Brown reports from Tel Aviv.
The Israelis appear to be serious about their insistence that the bilateral talks between themselves and the Arab countries must be held in the Middle East. Syria so far rejects this. Prime Minister Shamir reiterated the Israeli stand on his return home today, saying Israel simply will not proceed with the bilateral talks outside the Mideast region. Israelis say this is the best way to show a real commitment to the peace process, by entering the home of the enemy. It creates an atmosphere, Shamir said, when they come to us and we come to them. Asked if this amounted to an ultimatum, he said, I would say this is our demand. Shamir has left his deputy prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, in Madrid in charge of the Israeli delegation. On Sunday, the parties will meet again to continue the argument. For National Public Radio, this is Hillary Brown in Tel Aviv.
Croatian officials said today that the Yugoslav Federal Army has resumed its assault on the historic port city of Dubrovnik. Hostilities around the Adriatic port eased for a couple of days this week, while Yugoslav President Stipe Mesic brought the city a flotilla of humanitarian aid. That truce reportedly ended this evening when Federal Army units began to pound parts of the city with heavy artillery and mortar fire. Television reports from Dubrovnik said there were some deaths reported, as well as a great deal of material damage. The Russian parliament has voted to support President Boris Yeltsin's proposed package of rapid moves to a market economy and has granted him increased powers to implement the reforms. NPR's Mike Schuster reports from Moscow.
Russian parliament has voted overwhelmingly to back Boris Yeltsin in his bid to stop the slide of the Russian economy deeper into depression and chaos. Earlier this week, Yeltsin proposed an immediate unfreezing of prices on many food items and consumer goods, the rapid privatization of state industries, and the sale of land in the countryside. To help Yeltsin carry out these reforms, the Russian parliament has agreed to let him nullify any Russian or Soviet laws that he believes will obstruct reform and to reorganize the top levels of the Russian government. The Russian parliament also put off local elections across Russia until late 1992, thus granting Yeltsin the delay he has asked for, prevent the election of local authorities that might be hostile to his plan. I'm Mike Schuster in Moscow.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 13 points to finish the day at 3,055.9. Declines edged advances in heavy trading. This is NPR. Reports from Iowa City say that a gunman killed as many as 5 people and wounded an undetermined number of others before turning his gun on himself. The Iowa governor's office reported that the gunman was a graduate student and said that he killed the university's vice president of student affairs and a secretary before committing suicide. The shootings reportedly began on the street, then moved on to the university's physics building. The gunman then went to the university's administration building, where he killed himself. Winter has come early to Minneapolis and St. Paul, Minnesota. More than 20 inches of snow have fallen on the Twin Cities since yesterday, a 24-hour record, and it's still coming down. Bill Catlin of Minnesota Public Radio has the story.
Trick-or-treaters in ghost costumes blended into a heavy Halloween night snowfall, which began yesterday afternoon. Minnesotans are used to heavy winter weather, but not this early. Livestock and family pets are caught without winter coats, and some cities didn't have all their plows ready. slippery roads and poor visibility have led to numerous minor traffic accidents, despite closings of businesses, schools, and a long stretch of interstate highway. Commuters reviled the bus system and helped push out buses that got stuck. Some, like this woman, made the trip for nothing.
I came for a seminar and nobody's even up there, so I'm probably the only one to show up, so I could have stayed home.
The snow and strong winds are expected to continue into tonight throughout much of the state. For National Public Radio, this is Bill Catlin in St. Paul.
A gain in the nation's unemployment rate for the month of October has renewed fears that the economy may be headed for a second bout of recession. The Labor Department reported that the unemployment rate climbed to 6.8%. That was a gain of only a tenth of a percent from September, but it was the first increase since the jobless rate hit a five-year high of 7% in June. The report said that factory and construction workers were the hardest hit in the latest round of layoffs. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is exactly 2 feet taller than I am. So big deal. When he played in the NBA, he was taller than virtually anyone else on the court. But there's a lot more than his 7'1" height that set Wilt Chamberlain apart from other basketball players. He's one of the best shooters in the history of the game. At various times in his career, he led the league in scoring, rebounding, assists, and blocked shots. He averaged 50 points a game during one season. In 1962, he scored 100 points during one game against the Knicks. Chamberlain played for the Philadelphia 76ers and the Los Angeles Lakers, retiring from the NBA in 1974. He writes about life after basketball and about the game itself in his new memoir, A View from Above. Some athletes are lost when they retire from professional sports, but Chamberlain says his retirement didn't bring on an ego crisis.
I was one of the fortunate ones. 73-74 was my last NBA season as a player. I went on to coach one year in what was called the ABA for the San Diego Conquistadors. But being fortunate, I went straight from that to playing volleyball, professional volleyball, which had the same competition level that basketball had for me, and it gave me an outlet. So I didn't go into any kind of culture shock or job shock, so to speak.
Do you feel like you made any mistakes in how to spend your time?
Oh, I definitely did. In fact, that's why the book is a reality. I was reflecting in 1989 on my 80s and that whole decade, and I thought maybe it was a wasted decade for me. I was a very active guy in the 50s and very active in the 60s, activist sort of guy, and playing a lot of basketball and doing many, many things. And 70 was also full for me. But the 80s kind of left me doing just on the beaches of Hawaii and playing volleyball and working on my tan, and I didn't like the way that sounded to me when I was looking back at it. And so I wanted to write down maybe what I was all about in those post-basketball years, and it evolved into this book.
When you're not involved in a sport, does your height have a different meaning?
You know, people often comment on how I feel about my height. It's hard to tell people who are not of the same stature or close to it that, this is me. This is how I was since 14, over 40 years. I don't feel any different than you may feel at being 5'1" or what have you. What happens is only when I'm around people that make me aware of how tall I am by questions or gestures or whatever. Basically, it seems no different than me. You may have to duck through doorways. You're not comfortable in telephone booths, and places aren't built for a 7'7" footers. But other than those little slight discomforts, I feel nothing different except when it's expressed by others.
So you've been 7'1" since you were 14?
14, that's correct.
Was there a period where you were like growing an inch a day or something?
that's not quite an inch a day, but I went away to Virginia. My home is Philadelphia, and so we were from the Virginia area, and I went away to Virginia like when I was like 11 years old or something, and for two months during July and August. When I got back, my mother didn't kind of let me in. She didn't recognize who I was. I had grown about 5 inches in 2 months, so those inches did kind of come fast.
Was your height always an advantage on the court?
Well, height in most sports can be an advantage like basketball, but a lot of times it was a disadvantage because of how people viewed me. And what I mean by that is they gave a great deal of my accomplishments they credit to being 7 foot tall. That indeed bothered me because I like to deem myself as being a good athlete, possessing some of the qualities and characteristics that would make a good athlete in speed, stamina, agility, and those kind of things. But a lot of people only saw it as a height factor. And most guys of my era, and even of this era, you know, when you're this tall, you have to deal with those legs and arms. It's not as easy as people think it is. I was lucky. I was gifted in those areas. So physically, it wasn't a barrier, but mentally, it definitely was.
Well, one other question about your height. What kind of reaction do you get from people who don't know who you are, who don't figure out that you're Wilt Chamberlain, and they see you when you're very tall?
Well, let me say this. When I was young, you know, I was viewed as a freak. It's not a kind thing to say or a kind thing to feel. They really looked at me as young that way. But as our society has evolved and sports has become so prominent, once people see you, they immediately think, basketball and dollars, you know. And I mean, you know, and so they see this great dollar machine, you understand? And at 55, people say, hey, what team do you play for? You know, whether if they don't know me, they assume right away that I play for some professional team. And that to them is a bonus because all professional basketball players, the average one makes $1 million a year. So you have to have, you know, some real good luck going for you.
Right. If you're just joining us, my guest is Wilt Chamberlain. He's written a new book called A View from Above. Do you think that basketball has gotten taller on the whole?
You know, a lot of people say that. A lot of guys who want to equate to the fact that maybe the basketball today was better than yesteryear because the guys are bigger, faster, and stronger. Well, that's a lot of hokey pokey. Basketball players, if you compute the averages of 1960 and compute the averages of today to 1991, there's only about maybe an inch in difference in size, an inch going in favor of the guys of today. But if you take away some of the extremely tall guys, the Manute Bol of Philadelphia, 7'7", and a few other guys, 7'5", and 7'4", and you take them out of the lineup, the averages were pretty close to the same. And the guys who are the stars in the league were always about the same size, 6'6", 6'4", 6'5". So it has not changed very much as far as height's concerned.
You mentioned Manute Bol. You call Manute Bol in your book at 7'7" a sideshow, not a player.
Yeah, well, I was not trying to be unkind to Manute Bol. What I feel here, though, is that he was hired because he is a show, which what the NBA has sort of evolved to in many, many ways, becoming more show than technical players. No one can say Manute Bol is a technically good basketball player. He takes the position, though, of one that is a good technical basketball player from ever having a chance to play because he fills that position on the roster. He can only kind of like stand there and sort of block shots, and then in the rest of the game they stick him off in a corner somewhere. You know, so I have to think that he has been displayed and used as a sideshow, and I don't find that very, very favorable.
So from what you've been saying, you don't think the basket should be raised in basketball?
No, I don't know how much the average person really truly knows about a trajectory and about the game of basketball. But if you raise the basket, you would only make the game more applicable for the taller player because the balls would come off the rim a lot higher, so therefore they would have the advantage even more so. What you do is you widen the courts and you do some of the things that they're now doing by allowing the lanes to be more wide open so the quicker and more agile players get a chance to move around better. That's the best way to maybe to, you know, if you think that you need to legislate a little bit against the tall guy, which they did as I was coming along, they changed rules to legislate against me personally.
Yeah, well, why don't we bring that up? They changed offensive goaltending because of you. Mm-hmm. You want to explain what this is?
Yeah, well, offensive goaltending is when your opponents shoot the ball, and you are allowed to go up while they shoot the ball and maybe guide it into the basket or aid it or help it or just grab it and just throw it into the basket yourself. And they said it was unfair because I used to do that with great frequency, and the defensive player is not allowed to touch the ball once an offensive player shoots it while it's still going up. So it was something that I was able to do that other guys couldn't do, and, you know, and so they made rules against it. They widened what is considered the lane in which you have 3 seconds to cross. From the time I left college, they widened it so wouldn't allow me to be close to the basket. They did things like disallow you from dunking the ball, which from the foul line, they said that you had to stay behind the foul line. Before, you could put your foot across the foul line as long as the ball went into the basket before it was down on the other side of the foul line. They changed those rules. You used to be allowed to throw the ball over the backboard on out-of-bounds play, but because I could jump so high and no one could control me putting the ball in the basket from that way, they said that was illegal and made you have to pass the ball from the sides rather than over the backboards. There were a few things that they did.
Let me ask you, when regulations were changed because of what was perceived as your height advantage, how did you know that they were being changed because of you?
Well, it was quite obvious because they talked about it. And some of these things were only what I could do. We're talking about dunking from the foul line. No one else ever did it. No one else could do it at that particular time for sure. That dunking from over the backboard. I mean, I was the only guy who did it. No one else even ever tried it. So it had to be because of me.
Well, Chamberlain, when you were in the NBA, you broke the record for scoring, and one year you led the league in assists. Why did you end up switching at one point in your career from scoring to defensive?
Yeah, well, actually, you know, by leading the league in assists is still a part of scoring. I was asked to do some different things other than score because they felt as though I had the ability to do virtually almost anything that I wanted to do on the basketball court, and they thought it would make the team a more cohesive unit if I would maybe get them more involved and them just watching me do my thing. And they were basically right. I wonder, though, as I look back in retrospect, whether Will Chamberlain should have just kept on scoring along with the other things that he was doing. But it worked out well for me, and in the year that I led the league in assists, we also had a great basketball team and won the world championship.
Did you want to stop shooting yourself?
Well, I never really gave it a thought, but, you know, when you're on a team and you have your mentor and people suggest certain things to you, you try to do whatever seems to be best at the time for the particular team. You don't always maybe feel that way. I mean, as a player, there's many things they ask you to do that you feel maybe different than what you would like to do, but, you know, that's what a team's what's all about.
You had the reputation in some circles as being a, quote, selfish player. What did that mean to you, and did you think it was justified?
Well, definitely not justified. They always consider shooters and guys who score as selfish, which is one of the things I addressed in my book, that if you are able to put the ball in the basket better than someone else, why should that make you selfish? Some guys are able to pass the ball better than other people, and they are given the titles of being unselfish because they give assists. You know, some guys are great rebounders. How can I be selfish when I work so hard to get the ball? The toughest job in basketball is rebounding. I was the greatest rebounder in the history of the game. They said selfish because it's one way of demeaning what Wilt Chamberlain was all about, and these are some of the things that I address in my book.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Will Chamberlain, and he has a new book called A View from Above. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Wilt Chamberlain is my guest. Now, you were great at scoring with the exception of foul shots, and some people thought that was because you never practiced. In your book, you write it's because you had a psychological block. Tell me what the problem was with
foul
shooting.
Well, if I knew what the problem really was, I wouldn't have had the problem. I was a very good foul shooter in high school. I was an adequate foul shooter in college, and as time went on, I got worse and worse. I believe the more people focused attention onto it, the more I became sort of neurotic about what I was not doing. So it was really, I believe, a psychological thing. In fact, I went to a therapist about it, you know, and he tried to help me out, you know, for about 2.5 months, and I came away from the therapist. The therapist ended up being a great foul shooter, and I was, you know, still the same.
So what did the therapist do to try to help you with your foul shooting?
Well, he just kind of tried to talk to me about various things that were in my life and seeing where they may have some effect of what was blocking me out when I would also see. Foul shooting is a little bit different than shooting from the field because now you're coming to at rest. Now all of a sudden you're not doing these natural things with your body and in flow of movement and so on and so forth. You have to come and stop. If you were a hard rebound and running a lot, you had to bring your body to a rest and stop it and relax it and then do something which is not exactly as natural as a basketball player. And it comes to a lot of concentration. And apparently I was losing my concentration. So he tried to find out what was making Wilt Chamberlain lose his concentration at that particular point.
What were his theories?
He didn't really have very many theories, and that's why I left him. I tried for 2 months to see if he had something that would be helpful, but it never really happened.
All right. Now, you started with the Harlem Globetrotters, and you played with them for how long?
I actually played with the Harlem Globetrotters for 17 years. I started with them my first year before I entered the NBA, and I owe a great deal to the Harlem Globetrotters. In fact, basketball in general on the pro level owes a great deal to the Harlem Globetrotters. They used to play doubleheaders in the beginning of the league when they were in financial trouble, and people would come out and watch the Globetrotters, and then some would stay to watch the second game, which would be the NBA game. The Globetrotters afforded me the opportunity as a young man of color to fulfill a dream. I used to dream it one day that I could play with the Harlem Globetrotters and see the world and make people laugh and do some of the fun things you do, but also play great basketball. So when the opportunity came for me, I was quite honored. Even at that stage in my life, where some people consider me the best basketball player in the world, my dream was still to want to be a Harlem Globetrotter, not to play in the NBA. And so I got a chance to do just that.
17 years with the Globetrotters. How old were you when you joined?
Well, I started at 21, and I played, you know, right through my whole basketball career. When the season ended in NBA, I would go and join the Globies wherever they were in the world.
Oh. You retired at the age of 36, I think?
Yeah, almost 37. Mm-hmm.
How did you choose the moment to retire?
Well, you know, that question has not been asked, and it's a great question because I went to a little island off the coast of Yugoslavia, off the coast of a little town called Split, near Yugoslavia, and a friend of mine had a home that summer, and I spent 2 weeks just thinking and getting my thoughts together and seeing where I wanted to go. My 5-year contract was up with the Los Angeles Lakers, and I had to make a decision on what I wanted to do. I just thought it was time to do something else in my life while I was still younger and healthy enough to enjoy it.
I think lots of people try to stay in as long as they can, and mm-hmm. you could have stayed longer.
Yeah, I you know what? I think as I look back now, Terry, that I feel as though there was something else that motivated me. My heroes were Joe Louis and Sugar Ray Robinson and Willie Mays and guys like that. And I watched them in the latter part of their careers, and they were not the great athletes that they were, and I thought maybe they stayed a little too long. And I didn't think of myself as that way. When I left the NBA, I had just broken a record for percent shooting, which may last for quite a long while. My very last year, I was still leading the league in rebounds. I was still the number one shot blocker in the league and considered the number one defensive player. So I was still at the top of not of my game, but of the game in the NBA for the players of that particular time. But I must have thought more about the fact that that's also the time that one should leave is when he's at the top.
Right. Okay, well, Chamberlain, I think it's time to talk about sex. Now, as we read your book, we learn not only about the basketball records that you broke, but it seems you've broken a couple of sexual ones as well. Mm-hmm. You estimate you slept with 20,000 different women, and you average that as 1.2 a day since you were 15 years old. Mm-hmm. Who's keeping score?
Who's keeping score? Well, it sounds like that one is keeping score. Let me try to explain that to you a little bit. When, you know, if you have an involvement in life with sexual encounters, as I put it, that consume that much of your life, and you're writing a book about your life and what shapes the ideas and forms some of your opinions in life, you'd be really rather dishonest to preclude that from your book. If I told people I was a basketball player and they say, well, what did you do? Did you score points or what? And I said, yeah, I was a good scorer. Well, what does that really mean? If I tell them that I scored 100 points in one game and averaged 50 points a season one time, they get a better picture of what Wilt Chamberlain was about as a basketball player. So as I was sitting here writing my book, and I'm trying to explain these to my potential readers, some of the things I did off the court and how involved I was in sexual activities, I wanted to maybe keep it personal, but I also wanted to have have an idea of just how viable I was. So I went back and checked, some of my date books and some of my appointment books and try to remember and recollect. And I would add up, 1969, July, how many encounters there may have been, and prorated by 12, and do the same thing for 74 and prorated by 12. Then take those 12s and multiply them by 40, and I come out to the number of 20,000. Now, that may sound like bragging. One was not bragging. One was trying to make a statement of fact to show people what I was about. A lot of this happened during the 60s and the 70s when I believe there was a sexual revolution and women wanted to sort of equate with men and have the same freedom as men did. I was young, able and willing, and lucky I was strong. And I, so I did partake. But I'm not here to promote promiscuity. I believe that this is a different era, and we must be a lot more careful about those kind of involvements. And I practice safe sex, and I just kind of believe that you have to be a lot more selective. I have a great deal of respect also for women, so it wasn't a matter of conquest. This was a mutuality thing where two minds conceived and wanted something, and the bodies did it. It was an era that it happened a lot more, and I'm not ashamed of it. I'm just trying to tell people a little bit about me and what I was about.
So when did safe sex become an issue for you?
It became an issue for me when it became a noticeable socially that things could happen to you that would, eventually may kill you.
How long ago did you start thinking about this?
About 8-9 years ago,
Have you ever had relations with a woman more than a couple of times?
Oh, of course I have. Yeah, okay. Yeah, of course I have. And but I can understand you asking that. One thinks that, well, you have to go boom, boom, bam. No, I have, and many of the ones that maybe only one time are now very dear friends of mine. So, it isn't just the sexual, it's not all sexuality.
Some people would probably be really envious of your record in this area, and other people would think that you had a really serious problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've heard both things. First of all, I don't like to think of it as a record. It was a part of my life. But why it would be a problem for one to do what one enjoys and what really is kind of natural for a man, I don't ever deem that as a problem. I think those people have a problem, addressing it. That's my opinion on that.
Are you still on a sexual binge?
I still have that sexual desire, you understand? I mean, I'm forced now to control it a lot more than I once did.
Forced by what?
Forced by what's out there or what could be out there.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay. In your book, you write, "I was chosen to be a man of controversy." What do you mean by that?
Well, I'm outspoken, and I think a lot of people kind of cling on what you say, and not why you are really saying it. I believed strongly in situations that some people couldn't possibly see that I could possibly be involved in. I was a Nixon supporter, as a Republican. And being of color, a lot of people looked at that like you must be out of your mind. Instead, I dated interracially. A lot of people didn't like that. I spoke my mind about many different things. I was an activist, as I mentioned. And so I didn't sit on the fence on most issues. And therefore, that made me a controversial person. And also misunderstood with the controversy because of size and color in the society that I grew up in. A lot of people really couldn't relate to Wilt Chamberlain.
Any regrets about being as outspoken as you've been?
None at all. I mean, I haven't always said the right thing, but I've meant well about what I've said. I believe that the only way that you can bring attention and get some things done is to bring attention to those things. You can do it through verbalization, which I believe is the best way than going out and hitting guys across the head or starting wars.
Wilt Chamberlain, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It's a pleasure.
Wilt Chamberlain's new book is called A View from Above. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Thank you. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Tonight, all along Broadway, the bright lights will dim in memory of Joseph Papp. Papp died yesterday at age 70. He will be remembered as one of the most important producers in the history of American theater. Coming up, we remember Joseph Papp with a 1987 interview from the Fresh Air Archives. Also, film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new movie Billy Bathgate, based on E.L. Doctorow's novel about a teenage boy from the Bronx who attaches himself to the gangster Dutch Schultz. We'll also hear a reading from the novel by Doctorow himself. Singer Kenny Rogers has squeezed out yet another TV adaptation of his song The Gambler. David Bianculli has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. State officials say that a graduate student opened fire in two buildings in the campus at the University of Iowa today, killing five people before fatally shooting himself. Police said the gunman had a .38 caliber revolver when he was found in a college building. There have been unconfirmed reports that the assailant was angry because his dissertation for his doctorate had been turned down. There have also been reports that some of those shot were faculty members. On Capitol Hill, the defense bill approved by House and Senate conferees today appears to spell the end for the controversial B-2 bomber. This agreement limits production of the Batwing stealth bomber to the 15 previously authorized. NPR's Neil Conan has this report.
The House has voted to kill the B-2 for 3 years in a row now, and Democrat Ron Dellums of California says this agreement means the House has won.
I believe and will say to you unequivocally that from my opinion, that sounds the death knell of the B-2 bomber.
There is $1 billion in the budget for a 16th B-2, but only if the plane passes a radar test it failed this year, and only if the House and Senate both agree. There's also money to keep the production line open to make changes on the B-2s already built, and stealth supporter Sam Nunn, the chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, says that means the bomber is not quite dead.
I'd say the B-2 is alive, but not completely healthy.
If the plane passes its stealth test this year, Nunn said the B-2 could reappear in next year's budget. This is Neil Conan in Washington.
Also in Washington, the newest Supreme Court justice took the bench in the High Court for the first time today. There was a brief ceremony for Clarence Thomas at the U.S. Supreme Court. More from NPR's Nina Totenberg.
The swearing-in ceremony was actually the third for Thomas. He took the constitutional oath at a White House ceremony just 3 days after his narrow confirmation. Then last week, anxious to move into his chambers at the court and begin work, he took the judicial oath in a private ceremony at the court. Then today, he took that oath again in a formal public reenactment of the ceremony. Attending the swearing-in were three retired justices, but Thurgood Marshall, the man Thomas succeeds, was not there. Also not in attendance were most of the members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. Although a row of seats was saved for the committee, only Republicans Arlen Specter and Orrin Hatch attended. Afterwards, Thomas posed briefly for pictures outside at the Supreme Court. When reporters asked him how he's feeling, the justice replied, "Ready to get to work." I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
According to news reports from Romania, about 3 million homes could be without heating fuel this winter because of coal and firewood shortages. Officials say in some places, less than one quarter of the necessary coal supplies have arrived. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 13 points to close at 3,055. This is NPR News. 3 days of a Middle Eastern peace conference have ended without a clear sign of what happens next. Israel, Jordan, and the Palestinians have agreed to meet Sunday to talk about procedures for bilateral talks. Syria, which is opposed to an Israeli proposal to hold the next round of talks in the Middle East, has not decided as yet about attending Sunday's meeting. If all sides do meet Sunday, Secretary of State James Baker still may have to settle the conflict on where to proceed. U.S. officials have indicated that Baker may issue invitations to all parties, with possibly a compromise site being Washington. While civil war continues in Yugoslavia, Serbians living outside that nation are meeting this weekend to discuss their contributions to its future. NPR's Cheryl Duvall reports.
The Serbian Unity Congress represents an estimated 1 million people of Serbian descent in the United States, Canada, and other countries. During the organization's annual meeting in Chicago, President Michael Djordjevic says its members hope to foster a free market economy in the Serbian region after the civil war.
That part of the world will need what I would call human capital. We can send them millions of dollars and billions and set up another Marshall Plan and whatnot. If there is no understanding of the people who are going to use that money would be squandered.
Djordjevic suggests the formation of a kind of peace corps through which professionals and retired people of Serbian descent can share their expertise with their counterparts in Serbia. The Serbian Unity Congress meets through Sunday. In Chicago, I'm Cheryl Duvall reporting.
After 44 years, Pan Am has ended its operations in Germany and turned them over to Delta. Officials say that over the last 40 years, more than 65 million people took a Pan American airplane in Germany. In 1947, Pan Am started its world service. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. This weekend, NBC begins a miniseries that's the fourth entry in the Gambler series starring Kenny Rogers. TV critic David Bianculli thought the first three were awful, and he thinks pretty much the same thing about this new one, but he says at least this one's got something the others didn't, an all-out nostalgia gimmick.
After one telemovie and two previous miniseries, The Gambler is no deeper than the Kenny Rogers song that inspired it, if you can call that inspiration. Parts of this new four-hour installment, called The Gambler Returns, The Luck of the Draw, give new meaning to one particular line in that old gambler song, the one about knowing when to walk away. Usually, you watch a TV show because of the stars or the story, but that doesn't apply here. Kenny Rogers doesn't act. He doesn't even act naturally. Country singer Reba McEntire, making her major acting debut, is a natural. But with a script this bad, it's tough to notice or care. Put it this way, even Bruce Boxleitner, who co-starred in the first three Gambler movies, is absent this time around. When Bruce Boxleitner won't do something, you know it's trouble. The story is about 4 hours too long. It has the gambler traveling cross-country to attend the world's most exclusive poker game in 1906 San Francisco. And yes, it ends with the earthquake. But here's the real gimmick. Along the way, the gambler runs into more than a dozen characters from old TV westerns, and they're played by the original actors. Unfortunately, none of them is used very well, and the level of satire is on a par with this piece of dialogue from a wagon train cook, who's one of the few supporting actors, by the way, who isn't from an old show.
Hey! Ow! Grimy Mitchell for them rolled sailor.
One of these times, Cookie, I'm gonna stick that spatula in your gizzard.
Yeah, well, until you do, you just stay away from my tent. Go on. Whew. I would love to give that fool a whiff of gun smoke. Run his maverick butt right off of this wagon train. Of course, he's probably already ordered dead or alive by some lawman. I wish Diamond Jim get rid of him. Settle down in some big valley. Build a little house in the prairie. Surrounded by high chaparral. Well, that'll be a real bonanza for me. I'm getting too old for this wild, wild west. Well, oh! Better get them doggies rolling before these stakes talk turn into rawhide.
With that speech, actor Paul Brenegar gets more screen time than some of the real McCoys, so to speak. Yet for hardcore Western fans who don't mind snoozing through the main story to wait for glimpses of old stars, that patience will be rewarded. I won't list most of the performers and characters hidden in this Gambler, because what fun there is exists in playing TV hide-and-seek. But to give you an idea, you'll get to see the Rifleman, a Virginian or two, Cheyenne, and, sitting next to one another in the same card game, Gene Barry's Bat Masterson and Jack Kelly's Maverick. Look, I know it's stupid, and it's full of historical inaccuracies, and it doesn't even play fair with the legacies of the shows themselves. But somehow, the sight of David Carradine's kung fu hero popping out of nowhere helps this Gambler miniseries qualify as instant camp. It's a piece of camp, though, that almost belongs in a campfire.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Post. This is Fresh Air. Yesterday, we lost one of the most important producers in the history of American theater. Joseph Papp died of prostate cancer at the age of 70. Tonight, the lights on Broadway will dim in his memory. But he devoted most of his life to theater off-Broadway. His New York Shakespeare Festival presented free Shakespeare in Central Park. Off-Broadway, Papp developed A Chorus Line and Hair, which went on to become huge Broadway hits. He used the profits to support his more experimental productions. Papp nurtured the talents of playwrights like David Mamet, John Gare, George C. Wolfe, Wallace Shawn, and David Rabe. The plays he produced also helped launch the careers of actors like George C. Scott, Kevin Kline, Meryl Streep, Raul Julia, and James Earl Jones. When Papp stepped down as director of the Shakespeare Festival in September, New York Times theater critic Frank Rich wrote that he left the New York Theater an almost completely different place than he found it. Today we remember Papp with an excerpt of a 1987 Fresh Air interview. Although Papp has always been associated with Shakespeare, English was his second language. He grew up speaking Yiddish. That surprised me, but he saw a connection.
You know how melodic Yiddish is? Really,
yes,
as a
I
language.
Do, yeah.
And the key to Shakespeare is the melody. The ear is the key to it. But I didn't immediately go from Yiddish to Shakespeare. It's just that I had a teacher, naturally. You get the right teacher who is committed to Shakespeare, loves Shakespeare. And it was just in the junior high school. I sort of stumbled on Julius Caesar. And the word sounded so wonderful, particularly Mark Antony. And I began to memorize just the speeches.
Did you get to the theater much?
No, I didn't know the theater existed.
How'd you find out about it?
Well, later on, they took a bunch of us to, when I was in high school, to see John Gielgud's Hamlet. And that was the first time I went to the theater.
And you loved it?
No, I didn't. I thought he spoke in a phony fashion. I said, why couldn't he speak more naturally? You know, he had a tremolo in his voice. He's become a gorgeous actor now. But when he was young, when I was first exposed to it, no, the speech sounded very strange. He was British, you know. But it was very, you know, it was, oh, that this too solid flesh would melt. Now, you know, to a kid from Brooklyn and coming from where people spoke in ordinary ways, it was too high class. But I did kind of enjoy the show. But the speech to me, I said, I felt was too artificial. And so, I mean, later on I became involved with that whole concept of not having artificial British speech, but having good American speech. Not the speech I had at the time, because that was good Brooklyn speech, and it would hardly be acceptable on any stage, any time. But I prefer good American actors acting Shakespeare. I think they have the proper vitality, the proper energy, and in a certain sense, with the exception of the great, great British actors, are closer to Shakespeare than a lot of the Shakespeare I've just come back from London that I've seen.
Well, in the late 50s, you really made headlines in New York for bringing the free Shakespeare to Central Park.
I started with this notion of wanting to bring Shakespeare to the people without charge, and play in the city's parks, playgrounds, deal with the Board of Education. It was to bring with the things that I loved to other people. And I felt Shakespeare was understandable. I felt he'd been taken over too much by the academics, and they were controlling him, and he was being presented in a way that would turn a lot of people off. And so I made it sort of my commitment, and I've been with this for 34 years now, to bring the Shakespeare and to develop American actors to act the works of Shakespeare with the right emotionality, the right speech, clarity, but Americans. and not in a nationalistic way, but just clear, good American speech. The way I'm speaking to you now, I consider that fair American speech. There are people that speak it much better. But without any localisms in the speech, but without removing certain accents. I mean, I've had Raul Julia play all major parts. He's a Hispanic actor, and I don't want to ruin his marvelous accent. But he's clear in his speech. You understand every word. He has a marvelous ear. And then there's James Earl Jones, also a black actor. Now, he's worried about losing his negritude, he used to say to me. I said, you're not losing your negritude at all. Just go. You just keep what you have. It's just that the clarity was important, the final consonant endings of words. And there's nobody clearer. He has one of the greatest speaking voices. And so does Raul. Now, those are two prime examples of American speech. But there are certain unpleasant sounds in American speech. You can't talk this way. And when you can't say, now is the winter of our discontent. You have to say, now is the winter. You have to say the. You can't say duh. You can if you want to, but it won't sound very good. So you don't want affected speech. You want normal, clear speech and not sloppy speech. And when I say localisms, I'm not talking about accents, because there's a Southern accent, and I've heard a beautiful Romeo and Juliet played with a Southern speech, very soft, what light through yonder window breaks. Sounds quite beautiful. But the speech was good. The enunciation was good.
You've had shows that you nurtured in a nonprofit setting, and then they moved on to Broadway. But I don't think you've ever really tried to just move your operation altogether to Broadway.
There's no way to do that.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. Did you ever want to do that?
I couldn't do that because there's no way to know what play is going to succeed and what is not going to succeed. Broadway is a freelance operation. It's a commercial operation. If I have something that seems to attract a lot of attention, gets good notices, and people want to see it, I have to be very careful because some of the best plays I do never go to Broadway. Because they're too good.
Well, you know, some people have like Broadway in their blood, and no matter what they think of Broadway, they have to be on Broadway.
No.
There's a whole mythology. Or was that mythology ever in your system about Broadway?
Never, and still not. In fact, I really don't like Broadway that much, because most of it is vulgar. I mean, most of the things that are put on stage. I mean, I produce plays, and you'll find I always have one standard of work. I would do the same thing downtown at my small theaters. I have five small theaters in one building in Greenwich Village as I would do on Broadway or in the park. There's not a double standard. I say, well, I'm going to do this in a commercial way. I don't know what that means. I mean, we either do it well or we don't do it well.
One of the things you've really done is find black, Hispanic, and women playwrights whose work wasn't getting performed to a large public. It seems to me you've probably had to travel to really small theaters and performance spaces and out-of-the-way places to discover people. How do you do it? Do you have a routine for doing that?
No, it's not a routine exactly. Once you begin to operate in the proper way, you begin to generate a particular kind of work. You begin to attract people. I mean, black writers who thought they would never could be produced would come to me because they know that they have a chance. Black actors, Hispanic actors, they know we're not going to, you know, twit them around and pretend and cast in any kind of, symbolic manner, that we give parts to good actors. And I don't do it because I'm a liberal, because I'm not. I do it because I think it's the right thing and get the best actors, and I think New York is a multiracial community and should be represented on the stage that way.
What did you mean by this, I'm not a liberal?
Well, I don't like the word liberal to me has certain connotations. Which I don't identify with. I feel I'm more radical than I am liberal. I believe in liberalism. I mean, believe in the Constitution, the Bill of Rights. But I take stronger stands on things than just talking about it a lot, right? So, and I do them. It's not a theory to me. The Constitution is not a theory to me, nor the Bill of Rights, or the theater itself, and what it's supposed to do in a society. It has to have impact and meaning. It has to deal with social issues. The people themselves that are in it have to be part of this. The fabric of a theater has to represent the entire fabric of our society. And if you're going to go into the schools where you have black and Hispanic and Asian students, you're not going to bring in an all-white company and insult these people. And so that takes doing. And you have to train people. You work with people. It's not easy. There are some black actors that are just extraordinary and as good as any white actor. a lot of black actors and Hispanic actors haven't had an opportunity to be in theater and to work, and you have to spend a lot more time working with some of these people. The same is true in the general situation. People have been who have not been in the picture, not because of their, not because of themselves, but because of the way things work out, you have to make an extra effort in those areas, and we make that effort because it's my responsibility, I feel, and I assume that responsibility.
You've discovered and helped nurture the careers of a lot of now well-known actors.
Absolutely, and we'll continue to do that.
Yeah. Do you usually see something right away in them?
Yeah, certainly see something right away. That's why you're spending time with these people. Otherwise, you wouldn't cast them if you didn't see something right away. Otherwise, you wouldn't be working with this writer unless you saw something right away. You can tell quite clearly from the very beginning if someone is talented. Some people manage to continue to write, and some, if talking about writers, for example, some don't. I mean, some people win the Pulitzer Prize, and then they never write another play. We've had two of those people. We had Charles Gaudin, Chuck Gaudin, wrote a play, beautiful play, marvelous writer, No Place to Be Somebody, the first black writer to win a Pulitzer. And then we had Jason Miller, Jack Miller, who wrote that championship season, hasn't written in play. But I knew they were both talented writers and also actors. You can see in 5 seconds.
Theater impresario Joseph Papp died yesterday in New York at the age of 70. Our interview was recorded in 1987. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's happening on All Things Considered. Noah Adams is with us. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. Tonight, Robert Siegel reports on the issue of the Jewish settlements in the Israeli-occupied territories. Shelling has started again in the walled city of Dubrovnik in Yugoslavia. Croatians there under siege for more than a month now. Mar Lyson reports on the Pennsylvania Senate race. We'll talk with an assistant fire chief in Williamson, West Virginia. Hundreds of fires are burning in West Virginia and Kentucky and Virginia. Also, we'll hear a fictional account of what it's like to ride out a storm in the Atlantic Ocean. This is taken from the book Spartina, written by John Casey. And an opposition victory is apparent in Zambia. Longtime leader Kenneth Kaunda could be out of power.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. E.L. Doctorow's novel, Billy Bathgate, has been made into a new film starring Dustin Hoffman. In a couple of minutes, film critic Stephen Schiff will review the movie. First, from the Fresh Air archives, we'll hear E.L. Doctorow read from Billy Bathgate. The novel is about a 15-year-old teenager from the Bronx who attaches himself to gangster Dutch Schultz.
The book opens with Billy leaping aboard a tugboat where Mr. Schultz is taking one of his henchmen, Bo Weinberg, en route to a ritual drowning in New York Harbor. And this is the way the book begins. He had to have planned it because when we drove onto the dock, the boat was there and the engine was running, and you could see the water churning up phosphorescence in the river, which was the only light there was because there was no moon nor no electric light either in the shack where the dockmaster should have been sitting, nor on the boat itself, and certainly not from the car. Yet everyone knew where everything was, and when the big Packard came down the ramp, Mickey the driver braked it so that the wheels hardly rattled the boards. And when he pulled up alongside the gangway, the doors were already open, and they hustled Bo and the girl upside before they even made a shadow in all that darkness. And there was no resistance. I saw a movement of black bulk, that was all. And all I heard was maybe the sound someone makes who is frightened and has a hand not his own over his mouth. The doors slammed and the car was humming and gone and the boat was already opening up water between itself and the slip before a thin minute had passed. Nobody said not to, so I jumped aboard and stood at the rail, frightened as you might expect, but a capable boy, he had said that himself. A capable boy, capable of learning, and I see now, capable of adoring, worshipping, that rudeness of power of which he was a greater student than anybody. Oh, and that menace of him, where it might be all over for anyone in his sight from one instant to the next. That was what it all turned on. It was why I was there. It was why I was thrilled to be judged so by him as a capable boy. The danger he really was a maniac. Besides, I had that self-assurance of the very young, which was in this case the simple presumption I could get away when I would, any time I wanted. I could outrun him, outrun his rage or the rage of his understanding and the reach of his domain, because I could climb fences and hustle down alleys and jump fire escapes and dance along the roof parapets of all the tenements of the world if it came to that. I was capable. I knew it before he did. Although he gave me more than confirmation when he said it, he made me his. But anyway, I wasn't thinking of any of this at the time. It was just something I had in me if I could use if I had to. Not even an idea, but an instinct waiting in my brain in case I ever needed it. Or else, why would I have leapt lightly over the rail as the phosphorescent water widened under me, to stand and watch from the deck as the land withdrew and a wind from the black night of water blew across my eyes, and the island of lights rose up before me as if it were a giant ocean liner sailing past and leaving me stranded with the big, murdering gangsters of my life and times.
E.L. Doctorow reading from his novel Billy Bathgate. Stephen Schiff went to see if Robert Benton's film adaptation was worth the wait.
In a word, no. In fact, the saddest thing about Benton's version of Billy Bathgate is that it won't inspire anybody to go back and read the Doctorow version. Doctorow turned the tale into an amazing study of the banality of evil. He entered Billy's mind, the mind of an innocent who could recoil from Schultz's atrocities and at the same time admire and even participate in them. In Doctorow's hands, the story of Billy became a metaphor for the way all-American ingenuity and energy are perverted by the equally all-American lust for power and celebrity. In Benton's hands, well, it's just a gangster picture, and a sadly limp one at that. Dustin Hoffman plays Schultz in a way that I'm tempted to call ecologically sound, because he seems to be recycling old performances. He gives Schultz the drab grumble of his Willie Loman in Death of a Salesman. He throws in the unvarying sourpuss frown of Mumbles, the hood he played in Dick Tracy. And he even sometimes walks with the same awkward little totter he gave Raymond in Rain Man. This must be how Hoffman's performances usually look halfway through his movie's always stormy preparation period. Only this time he never finished preparing. He just quit in midstream. Still, as underwhelming as Hoffman is, he wipes newcomer Lauren Dean, who plays Billy, off the screen. When these two are together, well, it's not exactly a fireworks display. Not even when Dutch is demonstrating to Billy the shooting prowess of a couple of henchmen named Irving and Lulu.
Who's a better shooter?
Irving.
Why?
Well, we got them all in there. Nothing's wasted.
No, this ain't ladies' embroidery. It don't have to be neat. If you got the time to set it up and you need a clean hit, you send Irving. But if you're in a tight spot, you want Lulu standing next to you. Boom, 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 boom. It's all over in a couple of seconds.
From Tom Stoppard, who wrote the screenplay, you expect a little razzle-dazzle. But the only place you get any is in Nicole Kidman's performance as Drew Preston, Dutch's temporary mall. Kidman brings out the naughty girl insouciance of a debutante toying with mobsters and suddenly getting in over her head. You can hear the sound of money in her voice, in scenes like this one, in which she romances poor eager Billy.
You're Mr. Schultz's girl.
No, I'm not his girl. He's my gangster. Besides, you're the one who's been looking after me.
But why is a hot number like Drew even vaguely interested in a callow stoogelet like Billy? And what attracts her to Dutch and his gang in the first place? Life among these thugs is so dull that we never know. In failing to recreate Dutch's explosive charisma, Benton and Hoffman destroy the story from the inside out. We can't see the sacred monstrousness that attracts Billy to the life of an outlaw. All we see is a dumb kid who inexplicably wants to hang out with a grubby goon. Benton has taken a great American fable and removed the fabulous from it. The result, I'm afraid, is a movie with cement shoes.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Somali writer Nuruddin Farah. He writes in English. There was no Somali written language until 1972. The publication of one of Farah's novels resulted in a death sentence from his government. Now he's teaching at Brown University, where he has organized a conference of African writers. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.